You're listening to The Weather Junkies.
Oh, boy.
Large wedge tornado coming up into Tuscaloosa.
A winter storm warning is in effect for our area.
The snow, we can expect at least another 2 to 4 inches overnight. Then that snow is
coming. The National Weather Service in Huntsville has issued a tornado warning for northwestern Madison.
14 to 22 inches of snow!
Good Thursday evening. It's nice to be here on The Weather Junkies. I'm Tyler Jankowski, joining the show from Connecticut alongside Dakota Smith in Colorado. Dakota.
Hey everyone. Hey Tyler. Thanks for joining us tonight. Yeah, it's a chilly day in Colorado, but I think it's a pretty normal temperature outside. The sunny skies, you know, makes it feel like in the 50s out there. So nothing to complain about. Looks like we'll get some colder weather next week. How's the weather on the East Coast?
We got between 2 and 3 inches of rain in the last couple of days, and we need 6 to 12 inches to eradicate the drought. So it was a drought-denting rainfall. That was good. And going into next week, or at least late next week, it looks like we might have some highs in the 30s. But other than that, it's still pretty mild around here.
Yeah, that's good. That'll change, though. Yeah. So tonight we're supposed to bring you an interview with Dr. Julian Strova, but the audio is a little, whacked out right now. And so we're working on the audio. So we actually won't air the interview live tonight, but if you go to iTunes or whatever, wherever you listen to your podcast, we will include that interview in there. So tomorrow, Friday, if you're listening to this not live, then, you know, you have nothing to worry about. You're going to hear the interview. But if you're listening live right now, you won't have the interview. We're going to pause to play the interview, but there won't be any audio there. But we do have a pretty jam-packed front end of the show tonight, talking about weather Twitter and some of the things buzzing in the weatherverse. There's been a lot going on. Tyler and I have been off for, I guess, a week now, or 2 weeks ago we did our last episode.
2 weeks, yeah.
Yeah, so there's a lot to talk about. So I guess let's get into the first tweet here. Our first tweet comes from, actually, it's not a tweet. It's a Facebook post from the National Weather Service Birmingham. And this post created quite the buzz over the, I guess it was this week, earlier this week, there was a severe weather outbreak in, I don't know if they're calling it an outbreak, but there was a ton of severe weather down south in what's known as Dixie Valley, across Alabama, Mississippi, and then it went into some parts of Tennessee as well. Parts of Louisiana. And before that, the National Weather Service in Birmingham put out this post on Facebook, said, "Important, please read." And along with it was a picture of the state of Alabama with counties and two cities. And the purpose of the post was to inform people of where they live. And they said, "Folks, we can't emphasize enough how important it is to know where you live," in all caps. And they said things like, let's see, "You should have enough knowledge to interpret of your location and surrounding areas to do that for yourself. That way you're not wasting our time, your time or ours. No matter how much information we give you, it won't be much good if you can't determine whether your location is highlighted on the graphics." So their point is, you know, you have to know where you live to know what our warnings mean. It's a good point. I thought they could have handled it a little better. It was kind of, I don't know, they came off as arrogant, and I don't know. I thought they could have handled it a little better. A lot of people were okay with it. Some people had some with it. Tyler, what do you think?
I hadn't seen this. It looks like the top comments are fine. They're not bashing them, at least in the top listing of comments. But I don't see any problem with this. When I make a map, I always include city labels on the map if it's Connecticut or the region or zoomed in any more than just the U.S. or the East Coast, because I always make a map with the understanding that most people don't know where they are on the map. So if you can include a few anchor cities, hopefully they know they're south or north or west or east of those cities. So here in Connecticut, I almost always have at least Hartford and New Haven on the map. And then depending on what I'm doing, sometimes I'll add other big cities on the map. But I don't really think a lot of people know where they are on the map.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I just think they were kind of, I don't know, I guess as a government organization, I feel like you shouldn't be kind of condescending as they were. But that's just kind of my take on it.
I think they probably got mad that there were a lot of questions on graphics and posts that were already answered in the graphics and posts. Seems like that's the spark for this. Thanks for your, if you have legitimate weather questions, I guess that's a little.
I guess they just were fed up, you know?
Yeah, the idea that you should know where you are on the map is a good one.
Yeah, and it begs the question, is this really, the National Weather Service shouldn't have to, I don't know if it's their, it's not their obligation to tell you where you live, right?
No, I think it gets annoying when you have all these, when you have questions that are already answered. I think maybe that's what they were getting at.
Yeah, well.
But anyways, that's one Facebook post in our Twitter segment, so.
I've been trying to extend it to, you know, all platforms of social media. But really, it's just Twitter right now.
Yeah.
Anyways, let's go to our next post here from Brad Penovich. He's a chief meteorologist in Charlotte. And it comes with an animation. And the tweet says, how a small fire in Smoky Mountain National Park became a firestorm last night. # Gatlinburg fire. And I think it's a pretty nice, clean, straightforward animation of the fires and where it started and how they spread. It was a pretty bad situation down there in even parts of downtown Gatlinburg and the surrounding areas in Smoky National Park. I believe the death toll is now up to 10, which is pretty terrible. So if you've seen some of that video, it's just insane how quickly that fire takes over an area.
There were a lot of videos circulating on Twitter from hotels in the area. I saw one, and initially I didn't know what was going on, and then I figured out that it was a forest fire. Initially, I thought that the hotel was on fire, but people weren't leaving. But then it started to make sense. I'm on Wikipedia here. It says the population of Gatlinburg is about 4,000. But it's up there in the mountains. It looks like the wind played a large role. I see the 40 to 70 on that graphic. Is this a result of being in higher terrain?
I don't think so. I don't.
It was just really strong wind at the surface.
Yeah, because it was ahead of a front. And it was a southerly wind. So I think. Yeah, I don't think the terrain played much. I mean, you probably had increased wind speeds, you know, with some downsloping perhaps. But I don't think it was one of those things where, you know, the higher you went, the faster the wind speed. I think it was really just the weather setup. And but yeah, I'm sure some of the wind speeds were increased with some of the downsloping.
Like a perfect storm with, because we always think of wind enhancing brush fires, but this seems like an extreme case.
Yeah, I think it was, and it seemed like it took everyone by surprise, which is concerning. I sent a tweet out and asked if there are models to model, you know, specific fires, and there are some, I don't think they're good enough to give, you know, adequate warning for people to leave. I think. You know, people were getting the message at different times, and some people were evacuating while their house was being taken over. So
our next tweet comes from the Capital Weather Gang. It's a quoted tweet. They say, disappointed that the Congressional Science Committee would perpetuate this misinformation. Our reaction. And the tweet they're quoting is from a verified account, the House Science, the House of Representatives Committee on Science, Space, and Technology, and the House Science Committee tweeted, global temperatures are plunging, icy silence from climate alarmists.
The House Science?
Breitbart News link.
Yeah, so I was following this today. Capital Weather Gang did a really good job at kind of sorting out the issues here. And basically, I'm not going to, you know, talk too much about the Breitbart article because I don't want to give it any more attention that it deserves or that it doesn't deserve. But if you go read the Capital Weather article, we'll tweet it out. And they kind of dispel some of the notions that are said in there. And you know, the Breitbart article is trying to say, well, it's winter now, so global warming doesn't exist.
They carry it.
Kind of silly, if you ask me.
It's passion.
And yeah, that's kind of how I feel about it.
What type of stuff does this account usually tweet? This
Breitbart?
No, Science, Space, and Technology Committee.
They have some similar, actually, like kind of climate. I don't know. Denying's a bad word, but climate denying.
So it's not your.
I guess the one just the tweet before it was a climate denier, but a lot of them, if you scroll through, some of them are, you know, actual praise of some of the work they fund. But they definitely have a bias on tweeting the more, you know, anti-global warming stuff. But this was an extreme. I mean, to quote Breitbart is kind of crazy. For an official branch of the government, but yeah, Capital Weather Gang did a really good job at sorting that out. So, yeah, so let's move on here to our next tweet. It comes from Eric Fisher. He's a on-air meteorologist in Boston, and his tweet says, "Forecast record lows by next Wednesday are circled on this map," and it shows a nice map of temperatures forecasted by the National Weather Service. Two meter forecast minimum temperatures for next week, the middle of next week, I believe Wednesday, and it's cold. It's a lot colder than it is today right now across the country, but there are no record lows circled on the map. Now, and that's just a forecast, so we don't know if this is actually, you know, going to verify perfectly. But there's been a lot of rhetoric this week about how it's the outbreak is colder than ever, and et cetera, et cetera, and I think it's just because we haven't had a cold shot like this. People are trying to hype it up like something that it isn't. It seems like a pretty typical shot of cold weather.
I haven't heard those extreme claims, but I guess I'm not in Colorado. You're in the single digits?
So some of those claims, it was a Drudge Report picked it up, and that's when it kind of went crazy. Drudge picked up something that someone said about how they've never seen this anomalous cold before. And it's just kind of, it doesn't make any sense. I forget who said that. It was some, I don't know, some meteorologist or climatologist, I think. And Matt Lanza had a nice rant about it, actually.
I do enjoy these graphics here because it makes it easy to see where the records might be set. But the other thing that this helps us do is, see just how severe warm or cold might be, because so often we lose sight of where we usually are based on the averages. And you're exactly right. I mean, if it's not impressive cold, then don't call it that, or if it's not impressive warmth, then don't call it that. And I think a lot of times when you have a drought of extremes or records, then sometimes you kind of got to mix something up and come up with something that's juicy. And it becomes difficult when it's not actually happening, but you got to stay grounded. You got to, you know, you've always got to, you got to look back on what the averages and the records are and stay linked to those. Otherwise you lose your calibration.
Yeah. I, I really respect that. That's kind of your belief in that. And I think you practice that as well. I don't see you really, I follow you, you know, your public account on Facebook and Twitter, and you don't seem to sensationalize things that, you know, that don't deserve it or whatever. So yeah, that's a good summary of that. So we'll move on to our second to last tweet here. This is actually my read of the week as well. So I'll do a plug here. It is from AtmoLife, and you can follow them at AtmoLife. It's a blog that writes, they read pieces on various parts of the weather, but I think they come at a unique angle, and a lot of times they try to inject humor into there. And this post was titled, boldly titled, I shall say, "It's time for local TV stations to stop unnecessary severe weather cut-ins." And I think they probably went a little too far with the title, the title of the post. That's probably just to get some extra clicks on there, because I don't think they really believe that title. If you read the post, it's centered on a James Spann tweet that said that was basically shaming a customer, someone in the viewing area, who said, you know, the tornado warning's not affecting their area, and I'm sure, you know, all TV meteorologists get these types of letters. But it was a pretty, you know, polite request, and basically they're just saying, is there any way to fix this, because I don't want to be seeing a warning that's all the way across the state for me. I think she brings up a valid point. It's not really James Spann's problem. He can't really do anything about it. It's more of a programming thing. And I don't even know how you would change that, how you would make it so that when you're cutting in, it's actually for the area that's being affected. That sounds pretty tough. But anyways, he shamed them publicly, which I don't really think that's the right way to go about it. But that spurred this article by AtmoLife, and they talk about different ways to prevent this. And you know, it's kind of a controversial piece, but it was worth a read. Tyler, I'm sure you have a lot of feelings about this.
I did look at this article earlier today. My thought is that it's very hard to do what they want people to do. I mean, nowadays, well, first of all, you definitely cannot do it with an over-the-air signal. With an over-the-air signal, you're just broadcasting your TV station. There's no way to block that out or send out different signals. It's impossible. But when it comes to cable and satellite, which most people are on either cable or satellite systems as opposed to over-the-air, I think it's probably possible, but very hard, because you have all different providers, and you know, who flips the switch and how does that talk with all the different providers, whether it's Dish Network or DirecTV or many. I mean, there's a lot of local providers. I've driven by them in central PA. So it's just not the big dogs. So you have all these different providers. And I think the other side to the argument is, weather is not really a fine line in anything. So even if you were able to accomplish a fine line, what happens if a storm comes close to that line? When do you flip the switch? I really don't think this ever happens. I mean, I know the Weather Channel does local cut-ins. I think that's possible because they're on such a large scale. You can choose, it's reasonable to choose a state or two states, right, to do a cut-in, but on the local level, I just don't see it ever happening. I mean, like I said, those hard lines, when do you decide, even if it was possible, when would you decide? I don't know.
I bet the Weather Channel cut-ins are probably just as good as a local station cut-in. You know, it's the same, probably the same area, amount of...
Yeah, I think it's easy to decide on a couple of states, but once you get closer than that, it becomes more difficult.
Yeah. Yeah. So maybe it's a little unrealistic. That's what I take from your kind of wrap up of that. But
The final tweet comes from Michael Lowry at the Weather Channel. He says waters in the Gulf of Mexico averaged 84 degrees this hurricane season, the warmest on record by a mile. And the graph he has, 2016 is at 84 for the sea surface temperature average. And really, it's when you go left to right on the graph, it's going up. So in the 1980s, it was around 82. Looks like an average of 82 in the 80s. Now it was at 84. And the last couple of years, starting in 2013, it's just been a spike in the upward direction.
Yeah, when you have that much land around an area of water, the land certainly impacts the sea surface temperature more than it would in just like a, you know, in the middle of the Atlantic.
I don't think I've ever been in 84 or 90 degree ocean water.
It's like a hot tub almost. Yeah, a shout out, actually, kind of a side note. He was on the Carolina Weather Group last night. So shout out to them if you want to listen to them. Carolina Weather Group, they're on YouTube and you can find them on iTunes. Yeah, that he did a little wrap up of the hurricane season this year. And yeah, it was pretty interesting. So go give them a listen if you have the chance. So is that it for our...
That does it for this week's extra long Twitter segment.
Yeah, I had a lot to talk about. So yeah, sorry about the hot takes. So now we're going to go to our interview with Dr. Julian Strova. And yeah, let's take a listen to that.
Now we're joined by Dr. Julian Strova from the National Snow and Ice Data Center in Boulder. And Dr. Strova, thanks so much for joining us today. So I kind of want to jump in. I might be jumping the gun here, but right now the Arctic and Antarctic daily sea ice extents are at the lowest on record for this day of the year in the satellite era. So I'm curious, what is driving those daily minimums, and have you been doing some work with them right now?
Yeah, we've definitely been looking at it pretty closely. Causing the Arctic sea ice to be so low as well as the Antarctic. And obviously, you know, while they're both low at the same time, it's likely that they're not really related to each other because it's very different geographies and different times of year and different philosophies of what drives the low sea ice conditions in both hemispheres. But if we just think about the Arctic, what we do see is that this fall, especially in November, air temperatures have been around 10 degrees Celsius warmer than average over most of the Arctic. And this has in part been driven by really southerly winds that are coming up through sort of Fram Strait, going through past Greenland and coming up into the Barents Sea, driven by unusually high pressure sort of over Scandinavia and most of Eurasia, coupled with low pressure sort of over more the western Arctic. So for Greenland and Canada and Alaska have all seen low pressure. And so this pressure gradient has been bringing a lot of warm air from the south into the Arctic, and it also seems to be in part influencing some of the ocean circulation that's also bringing more warm Atlantic water into the Arctic as well. So both of those things combined make it really hard for sea ice to form, and where we see it unusually low is mostly in the Eurasian side, so sort of in the Kara and the Barents Sea Center.
So it sounds like there's a number of processes working to get this minimum, daily minimum in the Arctic sea ice. I noticed you didn't mention anything about like El Nino or global warming. How do you piece out the cause and effects? Cause there's a lot going on, and how do you like determine, okay, this, you know, some of the ice it's low because, you know, partly low because global temperatures are higher than average, partly low because of these certain weather patterns that have set up. How do you piece those things out?
Well, you know, typically it's really hard to decide how much, you know, global warming is impacting sea ice just based on observations alone. To do that, we usually also then turn to climate models, and you can run these models with sort of pre-industrial levels of CO2, and then you can run them with the observed records of greenhouse gases and look at how that compares to the real world and how the sea ice has been changing. And when you do that, you can't get the decline that we're seeing in the sea ice out, including greenhouse gases. So that's one way to assess it. We also recently just started looking at just the data record itself in terms of sea ice extents in the Arctic and cumulative CO2 emissions in the atmosphere. And when you plot those two together, there's a very strong linear relationship between the two of them. And that relationship suggests that for every metric ton of CO2 that's added to the atmosphere, you lose another 3 square meters of sea ice. So certainly we do know that greenhouse gas is playing a role, but you know, when you look at, that's what pretty much is driving this long-term trend, but the variability around that trend is mostly due to weather. So yes, there is this overall warming in the Arctic that certainly helped thin the ice and made it more vulnerable and melting out every summer, but like this November, one of the reasons why it is so unusually low has a lot to do with the fact that, yes, you had a low ice again in the summer, so you had the oceans have a lot more heat that it absorbed during summer, which delays ice growth because you have to release that heat from the ocean back out to space. So that takes a little bit of time, but then also we do have weather patterns that also can influence as well.
Gotcha. A lot of your work is observations of sea ice and pushing that to the boundary and trying to innovate the observations. So I'm curious, what are some of the ways that we monitor and observe sea ice extent, and what are some of the ways that you're hoping that we use in the future?
Well, our longest data record of sea ice extent really comes from the satellite passenger microwave data record. So this is observing the sea ice cover in the microwave portion of the electromagnetic spectrum. So even though there's not a whole lot of energy emitted by the Earth at these wavelengths, there's a very large difference between open water and sea ice in terms of their emissivity. So you can observe the Arctic whether or not it's cloudy or whether or not it's polar night, which is really handy because often quite cloudy, and then half the year in the dark. So this is our best data record, but it is pretty coarse spatial resolution, and it's about 25 square kilometers for the long-term record that we typically look at when we talk about sea ice. But obviously, one of the key measurements that you also want is to be able to know how thick that ice is. So that's where a lot of these new satellites, so ICESat-2 or Cryosat, have been really helpful in trying to get better understanding of how the sea ice thickness changing.
And are there any future projects that hope to increase, I don't know, resolution or increase the accuracy of some of the measurements?
Well, in the U.S. right now, there's nothing really planned in terms of passing microwave. The ICESat-2 launch, which should be happening hopefully sometime in early 2018, will be very useful to map thickness changes, and having it at the same time that Cryosat-2, the European Space Agency's radar altimeter, is flying, that would hopefully allow us to get at snow depth on sea ice, as well as improving the ice thickness retrievals. And snow depth is one of those variables that we don't have right now over the Arctic, and you sort of need to know how deep the snow is in order to retrieve the ice thickness from these measurements.
Gotcha. So I read one of your publications on the atmospheric infrared sounder. And so I was wondering if you could kind of give us an overview of some of the variability that you found in the Arctic using this instrument. And I was wondering if you could explain something that I don't know if how long it's been used, the term, but I saw in a publication, it was called dark warming in the Arctic. So I was wondering if you could explain your journal article and then maybe kind of touch on dark warming.
So we have looked at we've done a couple of publications using the NASA AIRS instrument, which is an infrared sounder, and it can do things such as give us water vapor in the atmosphere, cloud cover. There's been algorithms designed to also get moisture flux and heat flux. So being able to look at changes in the moisture content of the Arctic atmosphere, as well as changes in temperatures as well. So this is really handy for us to better understand, for example, what is driving both sea ice retreat and when it starts to melt, which we can see is in large part driven by the to the warm moisture air into the Arctic during springtime. And it also helps us to better understand sort of the atmospheric responses and effects from sea ice loss. So this enhanced transfer of principal mate heat from the surface, the ocean surface, into the atmosphere during autumn and winter, and also look at changes in cloud cover from the increase in moisture content in the Arctic atmosphere. So these sorts of satellites are really new tools to look at what's going on in the Arctic, both in the atmosphere as well as what we already know from the sea ice extent, so the other data records. So just data records only since 2003, really. So it's a pretty new satellite, but even during that time period, we've seen large changes in the Arctic atmosphere, and it is definitely becoming more humid, it's becoming warmer, and that impacts the
CA
as well.
Gotcha. Yeah, I guess I saw the title of that article by Melissa and Dr. Randall where it was dark warming, and it basically described what you just described, where ice is melting, you get warmer water exposed to colder air, the air warms, and you have a higher water vapor content in the air, and then you get more long wave and infrared radiation downwelling, which then increases surface temp of the sea, and then the cycle begins again, more ice melt. Just for our listeners there, I guess I didn't realize it wasn't a commonly used term, so sorry about that.
Well, yeah, I mean, maybe not to me, but I'm not really an atmospheric scientist, so maybe that is a term that's more used in that community, I'm not sure.
Gotcha, okay. So what are some of the, you talked a lot in the beginning about how weather has is like, you know, one of the major contributors to the variability of Arctic sea ice. How do summertime storms that, you know, you get some of these, I guess they're not called mid-latitude cyclones, but you get some cyclones and you get high wind speeds and you get certain, you know, advection of water vapor and air temperatures. How does that impact the Arctic sea ice?
Well, typically when you have a stormy summer and you have colder temperatures and you have these cyclones, you tend to have overall more sea ice extent because what they do is they sort of spread the ice pack out and cause a lot of ice divergence. But in recent years, even that's been changing because right now the ice cover's gotten thin enough. So when you have a storm that comes through, like a large cyclone, and it starts spreading the ice pack out, the ice is thin enough now that you form open water areas in between those ice flows that then can absorb more of the sun's energy and sort of enhance that ice LBO feedback. You're also now transporting some of this sea ice into warmer ocean waters, and depending on how strong that cyclone is and how much mixing happens with the warmer ocean temperatures below, then you can also get enhanced melting. And so I think in the past, when the ice pack was thick enough, you didn't really large melting out during these cyclones, but in the last few years, especially in 2012 when we had a really large cyclone into the Arctic sort of in August, then you did see sort of a rapid retreat of sea ice cover during that storm, and we also saw that to a lesser extent this year as well.
Wow, so how recent is that change in summer storm impacts on sea ice? Is that just the past like two or three years, or has it been...
I would say it's the past decade where you've really seen that the influence of the storms is even changing on the sea ice cover.
Wow. I'm not sure why, but that kind of blows my mind that a phenomenon the impact of it can change based on the thickness of the ice. Wow.
Yeah, because as the ice gets thin enough, when you spread it out and you transport it to warmer waters, now it can actually melt out during those events instead of, you know, just sort of spreading the ice back out and increasing the overall extent, but it was thick enough to still survive that, and now it's not.
Gotcha. Well, thanks so much for having a chat with us. We really appreciate your time.
So that was a great interview. Thanks so much for taking some time to talk with us. Learned a lot about Arctic sea ice, and the thing I learned from this was that weather has a huge impact on sea ice. It's less of a In the short term, short-term variability is all weather-driven. So yeah, very, very interesting interview.
Glad we're able to talk to her. I really wanted to get an ice expert on the show because if you've seen the graphs and the trend lines, the ice for this year is so much below the pack. And it'll be interesting to see what happens as we go into winter here in the northern hemisphere.
Yeah, you know, we're always showing Zach's images and graphics. So it was, you know, we might as well have someone on to talk about them. We ramble about them like, you know, chickens with their head cut off. And yeah, it's great to have her on to actually make sense of it and talk about her research as well. But I think that's going to do it for us this week. If you don't follow us on Twitter, you can follow us at the WX Junkies. You can also find us on Facebook. You can listen to this podcast on SoundCloud, YouTube, iTunes, any podcast platform. And give us a rating or a review if you can. Tyler, who can we expect next week?
We're excited to be back next week. It's December, the first full week of December.
And
we will be joining you live on Thursday evening. We'll announce the guest on Twitter here over the next couple of days. But thank you for tuning into this week's episode. And we'll see you right back here next week.